Well, it's been about 5 years, episode 70, in fact, since the face of Squash TV has been on the pod. Joey Barrington joins me today to talk about basically whatever he wants, but I'm hoping that we're going to get into Optasia, which was an absolutely amazing event, the upcoming London Open as well in about a week's time. And we're going to give Joey some space to lay out the JBPJ summer camps at Millfield School this summer. I think the focus is going to be on elite junior squash. So anyone with juniors playing the game at a decent level, I'm not sure if it's only elite juniors, but I think that's what I read on the website anyways. At any rate, Joey's going to lay all of that out and much more for us today on episode 290. Yeah, it's been that many episodes since we've had him on. Actually, not that many, but 5 years, and really looking forward to it. We speak a fair amount off the podcast, just through chat and stuff like that. So Joey's very accessible. So really appreciate his time today. But before we speak to JB, let's talk about our great sponsor, Open Squash. And of course, their mission is growing the game and making squash more accessible and more affordable for everyone. Open Squash currently sponsors the very best in the game, Gina Kennedy, Victor Quinn, who's playing in Australia at the Australian Open and making inroads towards the finals there. Hannah Craig, she's in the top 100 and one of Open Squash's elite coaches there. And of course, world number one, who had an absolutely amazing Optasia, came up just a bit short, but what a final that was. Ali Farag, world number one, and he never ceases to amaze. In fact, Ali has taken on the role of senior advisor at Open Squash, along with his former Harvard squash coach, Mike Way, and also Mike Way, as we all know, former coach to former world number one, Jonathan Power. Anyway, summer is fast approaching, and Open Squash, as always, will be putting on amazing clinics given by some of the game's great coaches, and this summer is no exception. Camps will be headed by the aforementioned legendary Harvard head coach, Mike Way, former world number one, and Drexel head coach, Johnny White, along with Gina Kennedy, Victor, and several other highly respected coaches will be putting on summer camps and clinics. They've even recently added intermediate clinics. And also, you even have about a week left, I believe, to avail yourself of the early bird camp discounts, which end on April 1st. So visit opensquash.org to sign up for the camp that fits your skill sets. That's opensquash.org. And now, without further ado, it's man crush time with Joey Barrington. Joey, I really appreciate your time. I know time is precious for you. You've got like 2 weeks, and then, well, I guess last week and this week, and then you're off to London, I would imagine.
I'm off to London on Wednesday.
Yeah. So more great squash coming up there. Yeah. Optasia was absolutely amazing. But, it was episode back in the early days. I think you were gracious enough to come on. It was episode 70. Today we're episode 290, so it's great to have you back, man.
Yeah, it's a good number. I'm pleased. 290 is a good number.
290. Yeah, yeah. I wanted to bring you on for 300. I thought that would have been more appropriate, but you said cool, let's do it now. So I had to take it while it was there. So anyways, so you've had a couple, weeks of reprieve. Before we get into Optasia, London, and the JBPJ squat summer camps that are coming up, before we get into that, have you had a bit of R&R over the last couple of weeks?
No, I'm modern man, Jerry. So no, I don't get any R&R at all.
you've got a young, well, at least one child, right?
I've got two. I've got a boy, 9-year-old boy, who's aptly named Jonah, which is original. And then he's nine. He's a very good runner, which is great. He's not going near a squash court at the moment. And then my little girl, Bliss, with a spelled BLYSS, which is the old English for intense cheer and happiness. She's probably will go near a squash court because she's kind of ball crazy. Or she might play football for England. I don't know.
Right on. Okay. Either way, that's fantastic. How old is Bliss, did you say?
Three. She's three.
Three.
She's
Okay.
yeah, she's a firecracker. So yeah, she's great. So yeah, I try and spend as much time because obviously I've got the England squash role as well. So I coordinate that on top of my PSA work. It works well, but it's obviously busy, busy, busy.
What is the, I mean, for those of, for anyone who doesn't know, what's your role with Squash England?
So with England Squash, my role is commercial partnerships manager and membership manager. So I basically look to get sponsors in, deal with all the partners that are with England Squash, and try and get it more commercial, looking to get it a lot more commercial because it relies a lot on government funding and a little bit more independent from that. And then the membership, they've launched a new membership scheme for the first time in 20 years. And it's going to be pretty crucial to the organization, and it's an exciting time. So I cross over those two areas, but I also go into a lot of other areas. I've been dragged into some of the reffing side, which is we've got a lot of work to do to get things going in England with that, which is we've made some strides already. I can't say anything yet, but that we've got someone coming in who's going to be superb. And then this the league actually, which is taking up a huge amount of my time. So the PSL became defunct. There was only four teams in it for the 23-24 season. They were basically not keen to go ahead, and rightly so, because there was only four of them. And then it was kind of given to me. So I've revamped the whole thing. I'll be going completely public with it in a couple of weeks. But I've done a lot of kind of on the ground research with loads of clubs that have been involved in the past, new clubs, people that I regard highly in the squash world to get their advice and what they feel with my ideas. And it's been really, really positive. It's pretty much been 100% positive. So I'm really excited to launch that in kind of mid-May. When I say launch it, going public with it, and then the it will start for in September for the 24-25 season.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Has your, the role you're taking with, the commercial side of things and growing, Squash England that way, have you found the LA 28 announcement? Has that had an impact on anything?
I mean, we're going to find out what funding we get from the Olympic side of things, the amount probably by the end of this month, which will be interesting, but that will be geared more into the performance side, to get medals. But from my aspect, I've already been kind of doing a lot on the, I'm very passionate about the grassroots and the participation side. I love doing the TV and the shop window for the PSA, where it all looks fantastic with the pro players on the glass courts in all these amazing locations around the world. But, I get such a kick and a buzz from seeing little ones playing and people getting on there and getting stuck into to playing. So I've also focused heavily on the grassroots side. So we've signed a few partners for in terms of facility, equipment and things that we'll be going be announcing soon. And it's getting the numbers up really, Jerry. So that's a really, really important side for me. If we can't get the numbers up, then there's no future for the game. So all these people in the country that are doing independent programs that are brilliant, they need to be helped and recognized. And there's some really, really quality people that are outside the governing body doing these things. And they just need they need to be helped, and they need to be encouraged, and they need to be given publicity and everything else that can be done. Because without them, there literally wouldn't be anything. The governing body have some good programs. Don't get me wrong; they've got some programs in place, but the independents are doing unbelievable jobs. And I'm finding out who they are and collating that. And we're going to start kind of looking at a plan to try and help them with their programs. And we don't have the manpower to do it all ourselves in that respect. So it's working with them and making sure we get the best out of what they're doing, and they feel that they're being supported by the governing body, which is really important.
That bodes well. I just had Adriana Olaya on. She was on my last episode talking about the Squash Summit, and she's a bright young lady, and she's really, I think, put together something really exciting and along those lines, growing the game and bringing everybody together during the British Open. So
Yeah,
that's
the
exciting
Squash
as well.
Summit. Yeah, the Squash Summit's going to be very good. So, hopefully there'll be a really respectable turnout for that, because everyone that wants to get the game going from a participation side, outside of the PSA pro side, should be there within reason. Within reason, should be there.
Brilliant. Now, before we get into all the optasia and all that other stuff, I wanted to ask you this. When did you start as commentator, I guess lead commentator with Squash TV, or even before Squash TV? When did that all kick off?
I did a few when it was the old PSA Live, which was kind of one Adrian Battersby, which was literally him turning up with a modem at all these events, at Bermuda and all these things. And it was pretty crazy, really. So he literally used to travel just with the stuff in his bag and set it up and used to get the players in. So I did a few of those. And then I did a Sky Sports show that was it wasn't a live show because somebody couldn't make it. And that went down really, really well. And then when Squash TV was kind of in the making, which was basically the initiation of Alex Goff, Lee Beachel, and Ziad Al Turki, I did the pilot, which was in December 2009 at World Championships in Saudi Arabia. And I started commentating. Robert Edwards was kind of doing some of the early round stuff, but then we launched on the quarterfinals, and I did the quarterfinals with Wael Al Hindi, and then all the way through semis and finals to that amazing final with Nick Matthew and Rami Ashour. Which was an epic battle when Rami won in five, and then we went officially live January 2010. So that's I've been in from the very, very, very beginning. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's a while ago, but it must seem like yesterday for you.
I've done over, at some point I'll get the exact figure, but I've done over probably 10,000 matches, I think.
Well, the reason I ask is because I remember back in the mid to late 90s, and this was kind of tape delayed stuff, but I remember your dad, the living legend himself, Jonah.
Yeah.
He was doing the commentary. I think it was the Hong Kong Open. It was Star Sports, a Hong Kong based TV sports television broadcaster. But I just remember how eloquent he was, how insightful he was, how entertaining he was. And it was just real. I mean, I loved squash. I loved watching the program at that point, but it just excited me even more. And I think you generational approach that you take is actually quite similar to the way your father approached it. Just wondering, I guess back at that time, did you what did you take away from his approach to commentating? Because he I mean, you'll agree with me, he was just amazing at
it. I mean, he is now. I mean, he's just, there's nobody from a speaking point of view, he could have had a massive career in TV, and that could have crossed over in loads of sports with my dad, because he's so knowledgeable on other sports and so passionate about sport in general. He wanted to go down the coaching route, and growing up, he kind of sold himself a bit too short, really. I mean, but that's what he wanted to do. But from a TV side of things, when you watch him in the old Question of Sports, and when he's been on TV, and when he's done public speaking, he's never written stuff down. He speaks. And there's no ums and ahs and all these kind of, he just speaks. And it you can't help but get captivated, because he's articulate, but he's also got something about him. And you have certain people with auras that you can't necessarily explain. His aura comes with, even seeing him now, he has an aura, you know, and it's just something unique to that person at times. Yes, the aura can be enhanced by what they achieve and their fame in terms of that, because you see them everywhere, and then suddenly you see them in person, you like see this massive glow from these people. Doesn't always happen though with famous people, because there's other famous people that you would walk past in the street and not even, you know, take two looks at. But he obviously, I heard him talking a lot growing up. I wasn't that interested in squash, but I suppose you learn a lot from it. And I've done some commentating with him, and that was pretty amazing. I was having to refer to him as Jonah, which I always found cool, because I've always called him Dad.
Right.
And we did some stuff together, which I loved. And that, you know, that will be there until the end of time. It was recorded. We did Canary Wharf. We managed to do the epic Nick Matthew, James Woolstrop semi-final at Canary Wharf, where James cramped just before match ball, which was one of the best matches ever on Squash TV. It was outrageous. It was one of those ones that was brilliant from the word go, and it went all the way to the wire. We did that together, and we've done some cool stuff together. But he's amazing. And what people need to understand, when you've got myself and all these other commentators I work with, who, you know, are great people, when they say words like squeeze and all these, this is all his terminology. You know, it's his terminology. The guy invented ghosting. He certainly, everyone went on and practiced on their own, but he certainly shaped the solo practice. He certainly shaped the pressure session scenario. I mean, he invented all these things, and people don't realize any of that. And we did a squash skills thing a while ago, and on ghosting and on solo, to get the point across that he did actually, you know, he invented ghosting, so he didn't have people to play. Jeff Hunt was playing with Kenny Hisko, another great Australian player, with Jeff, and they were playing practice matches with each other till the cows came home. My dad was based at one point, you know, in Birmingham, and there wasn't as many players. He had some of the Egyptians that came in a bit later on, but he was having to replicate movement and keep sharp by ghosting. So shadow movement, shadow boxing was, you know, it was he saw shadow boxing and he thought, I can replicate this on the court. So the terminologies that are used even now are just copying his terminologies, you know, tight and squeeze and all these things. And,
Well, a couple of things that I picked up, some funny expressions I'd never heard. I mean, I think it's just a cultural or, you know, I'm Canadian. In the UK, you use expressions like purple patch, I think.
Yeah.
You mentioned purple patch, fertile wrist. I'll never forget that.
Yeah,
power with wrist. The fertile wrist and the languid Canadian.
It's amazing. You know, it just, you get people that just have that ability to do that. And when you kind of assign it to sport, it's pretty cool. And there's a lot of kind of very average commentating in a lot of sports. So there's a lot of average commentating in tennis. You hear Wimbledon. I was listening to a bit of Wimbledon in the summer, and it's really average. And I wanted to make the point also that you get people with their opinions on squash stories, which are always, you know, there's some good stuff on there. There's some great historical stuff on there. There's stuff that's chucked on to really get people going. And then there's a lot of negative stuff at times, a lot of negative stuff. And what people got to realize is that you can over-talk, of course, but unlike tennis, they commentate after the rally. That's what they do. In squash, you're not facing an opponent, all right? You're not separated by a net like table tennis, badminton, table tennis. You've got this bizarre situation where you can lose your opponent for periods of time because they're behind you. You don't know where they are. And you've also got rallies that can go on and on and on. And when you've got two players hitting the ball up and down the left-hand wall, when the rest of the court is being could be utilized to a person that's not a squash viewer, it's weird. So you need to try to, because with our commentary, of course, we want to give the squash diehards what they want with all of the squash terminology and the intricacies of it. But also, we're trying to grow the viewership. So you have to bring in other aspects that at times can possibly be sounding a bit basic, or why are they talking when they're going down the backhand wall? It's like, because we're trying to actually realize that these guys are looking for a quick move or a position on the court to open up or whatever it may be. If you didn't say anything, imagine it's completely, and you've got somebody that puts on TNT in the UK, you've got these two players going up and down the wall for a minute. It's the weirdest. Well, it would be bizarre, but it's weird, isn't it? It's weird. Yeah. So, you know, you've got to talk within reason. Within reason, you know, you've got to say something within reason. But of course, overkill on the talking is irritating for everyone in any sport, really.
Right. Well, I think you guys do a fantastic job. But I just wanted to give my own little shout out to Jonah there as well, because I just remember the Hong Kong Open. It was JP and
he did all the BBC stuff.
He did all the BBC stuff.
You know, he did the original BBC. He was commentating on Jeff Hunt and Jahangir, the British Open in the early 80s. You know, he was commentating from the word go, from when it was actually starting to get broadcast, the squash.
Right.
So what people have said seen later on with the shows, but he was doing a lot of the BBC broadcasts originally.
Well, he had some celebrity as well in the UK back then. I mean, he was on the TV with these celebrities.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, that was great for squash back in the day, obviously.
Yeah, amazing. Well, there's nobody that's transcended the sport. There's nobody. Yeah. You tell me one person that's transcended the sport apart from him. Who else has transcended the sport?
No one recently anyways. No.
No.
No. But anyway, Joey, Optasia. That was what a surprise. I mean, that's one of the best events we've seen in a while, just in terms of the storylines. I mean, let's talk first. I mean, you couldn't script it the way it turned out. Let's talk first about the men's final. Obviously, Paul, he won it. I want to talk about Ali though first. What an incredible performance. I mean, he had me on the edge of my seat the whole match. He was up to love, but you knew it just wasn't going to work. You knew it wasn't going to happen for him, even though he usually tends to pull these matches off. Talk about that final and just how special, even in defeat, that match was for him, because he's had such an incredible 2024. And to me, even though he lost that match, this just adds to you know, how well he's been playing.
Yeah, I mean, Ali is, I mean, the best thing that happened to Ali was the knee injury, because you got, after the knee injury, you got the Mark II version. Before the knee injury, he was obviously winning titles, but he got caught a couple of times by Paul in the British Opens, where Paul played an immaculate game of accuracy to the back and no errors, and could be on there for X amount of time. And Ali wasn't, in my opinion at that time, fit enough at that level to deal with it. And then he's gone back, he's worked after the knee injury on his body, and what we've got now is the very best version of Ali Farag. And when those two play, Paul and Ali, they do bring the best out of each other, and you've kind of seen that from the battles that have ensued throughout 23-24 season. He's very humble about the whole Ramadan scenario, and I've had some people write to me saying, you know, you don't need to mention it and this, that, and everything else. Well, I do need to mention it, because it's massive. And the difference this time round was when he won the British Open during Ramadan, he was way into the Ramadan. It was 3 weeks into it in the British Open last year. It's also brought forward because it's a lunar, it's related with the moon. So it's happening earlier this year, Ramadan. And he was only a few days into Ramadan when he did Optasia. Now, if you look through the squash, I mean, I found it tremendously entertaining and excitable when I was commentating, but at times Paul wasn't playing particularly great squash. And Ali was, you know, the guy was asking for some water at one point, because he was, you know, I mean, he's so humble, because he says we're used to it. And he has been doing it since he was probably 5 years old, or whatever age he started. But because it's just the beginning of Ramadan, to have that event there and then hit him hard. I've never seen him lose his legs like he did, you know, and he lost his legs. I mean, you're going to lose your legs. You're perspiring so much fluid. And he was getting redder and redder. He never gets really red in the face when he's hydrated and properly, you know, outside of Ramadan. He sweats. He doesn't, and he wasn't sweating because there's no fluid to sweat. And it's a dangerous scenario. I mean, you can do serious damage to your kidneys, to your muscles, to, you know, even your brain, if it goes on and on and on and on and on because of severe dehydration. I did find it a little bit funny because Paul gave it the old Superman big arms. And apparently I've heard he doesn't like his nickname, which from him straight away, I know he does, because one, he has it on his shirts all the time as Superman. And two, he puts his arms up and does the Superman pose. So that whoever, I know who says that, they can, you know.
Yeah, he wouldn't wear that name on the
No, back. With all due respect, they can shove that. They can shove that where the sun doesn't shine, because he does. But he was kind of giving it one of them. And then you've got poor old Ali Farag, who's literally flapping about because the bloke can't even, you know, his mouth's literally sewn together. which I did find a little bit like, you know, but Paul's got a great respect for Ali, and Ali's got a great respect for Paul. But I did find it a little bit like, You know, it's like the old it wasn't a level playing field. It's Ali's choice, don't get me wrong. There are other players that are Muslim that wouldn't adhere to it but would possibly make the days up outside of events. But he adheres to it. I know for a fact that he definitely adheres to Ramadan. He doesn't try and pull the wool over the eyes and stuff. So I did find that a bit at the end. But it was, you know, he's very gracious. And then you hear Paul speaking about him. And, of course, Paul's adapted his game.
Absolutely.
Paul's adapted his game. He's adapted his game. He's come back after his summer of 23, getting some good work in, trying to work on the, you know, continue on the technical side, the attacking side, the deception. And you can see that coming in. He's becoming more complete, if not now complete for Paul Cole. And then Ali's obviously that says, but that's what you want. That a rivalry for me is when, you know, they come up with something that tactically might be a bit different to what's happened, and then they get a result. You know, Ali Farag's been using a lot of height more recently against Paul, and playing Paul at his own tactic that he used against Ali Farag at the British Opens and all these different, you know, a few years ago. So he's then adapted this, and Paul Cole's been taken up high, and it's been, you know, getting into him. And I was watching in Chicago because I was commentating, and Paul Cole's legs buckled in Chicago a couple of times after some brutal rallies, you know, and Paul had had a very easy run through to that final. Whereas in the US Open, Paul had an absolutely brutal run through and was playing these amazing 3-2s, you know, these long matches to get there. And he obviously got the win over Ali in US Open, but he'd had this very comfortable run through. And his legs were going, you know, he was getting punched drunk at times. And that's because Ali, with his web weaving, tactical changes, making Paul uncomfortable. It's brilliant. You know, it's superb. And it's played obviously with the most intense vigor, but they have a great respect. So it's not like they're patting each other on the bum every 2 seconds to say, oh, well done, old chap, and all this, but there is a really great respect there. And it's cool. It's good. It's much needed.
Yeah, definitely. I was going to just say, just to add to that, I mean, what I thought for Paul anyways, I mean, he was in a tough situation. He obviously, he could see what was going on with Ali, and to stay focused under those circumstances to come back from two love down and to sort of just, you know, just try to win the match basically and do what he had to do to win the match despite, you know, what was going on with Ali. That was pretty impressive, I thought.
Yeah, and it was that backhand drop shot that won in the match in the end. You know, that was a big pressure situation. His backhand drop shot is a real mainstay for Paul. And, you know, he's been doing all his breathing techniques. He's been doing a huge amount of visualization. He's been doing this for quite a long time, and along with the technical side. And he obviously released himself brilliantly to play that shot at that time, because that was, you know, a monumental backhand drop shot at a time where, you know, he had match ball, championship ball. Although I have to say, although he was announced on court as the runner-up by Michael Absalom, who's a fantastic MC.
We hadn't seen Michael for a while.
We haven't seen Michael. We might not see Michael for another while now. No, I'm joking. But he's a great MC, but that was quite funny. it was quite funny. Anyway.
it was kind of noticeable too, though, or just sort of when things were not going well for Paul, you could see the body language as well. I think you mentioned that, like, his body language got a bit, you know, he looked a bit down there for a bit, and then I think, you know, once he sort of got back into the match,
it happened in Chicago. You look at the result of Chicago, which went into the tiebreak in the fourth. Ali was serving at 9-6 or 10-6. It might have been 10-4 or 10-6 in the fourth with numerous championship balls. And he served one, and Paul barely moved to try and play it and hit a shot. And it was basically a stroke. Paul got given a let. And then Ali, I think, made an error. And then suddenly Paul just started getting into it again. But he was in his shell at that point, and literally had given up the ghost at that point. And then suddenly you find how it changes on a whim like that. And Paul's getting in, he's getting more rallies. He's getting more points. It's getting close. And then you suddenly have this 16-14 tiebreak or whatever it was in Chicago. So you've got to be on your mettle all the time, obviously, if you're in that position. I mean, it's, but that's how it changes at the top level from my, you know, my perception of it as a commentator, having seen so many matches and seeing that scenario and commentators on them, you see how it can change when somebody makes a little bit of a mistake with a big lead. You just don't know how it can suddenly, the body language can change and it can reverse.
Yeah, absolutely. And then on the women's side, obviously, you had the amazing Satomi Watanabe. She came out of, I wouldn't say she came out of nowhere, because last season she had some big wins. She did really well last year. She's kind of put herself on the map there. And then in the final against Nele, am I pronouncing that correctly? Nele.
Nayla is right, and then it's meant, it's apparently it's Chilis, but I mean, yeah, that's the kind of Flemish version. I mean, every time I do that, I end up spitting on PJ, so I don't really want to do that. So I go
Nayla Chilis. Okay. But Satomi, I mean, she just, I mean, from last season played well, and she's been, you know, doing the same this season, and in that final she could do nothing wrong, and she just played brilliant squash, had the perfect game plan, and I think caught a lot of people by surprise. Were you surprised?
No, I wasn't surprised. I've been kind of, she was my one to watch for the 23-24 season. After I started seeing her make some inroads at the back end of the 22-23 season, Manchester in particular, where she beat kind of Tesnyev and Sarah Jane Perry and then lost to Nayla in four games.
Yeah.
My dad had actually picked her 4 years ago. He picked her 4 years ago. Yeah, he picked her 4 years ago. He was looking and he saw the World Junior stuff and everything, and he picked her 4 years ago. And that needs to be noted. But what was impressive this time around for me is that she's troubled. She's got a game off of Gohar before. She got a game off of El Hamami and should have actually gone 2-1 up against El Hamami in the TOC. She hit her with the ball, and it was her right to actually take a stroke. She played a let. The fact she was troubling those big guns, those big players in that way, it was sounding alarm bells. But what was interesting for me was her adjustment from the Melissa Alves match, where Alves was amazing down the backhand side, outplayed her and was very close. I should have won. She had championship. She had match ball, Alves. The adaptation of the next round she came up against Jazz Hutton, who just had a massive win over Sarah Jane Perry. She'd never beaten her before. So that was quite a, you know, that became quite straightforward. Plus Jazz Hutton was getting over an ankle injury. So that was straightforward. So that kind of got her back on track physically, mentally, after quite a nervy, emotional 3-2 win over Alves. And then the final, her tactics in the final were bang on, because she kept catching Nayla Gillis with the flick, the forehand flick. She got her on seven, maybe eight occasions throughout the three love match.
Well, the way she described it in the post-match interview was awesome, wasn't it? I mean, she basically gave away her game plan there. So.
Yeah, I know. But that's the kind of other side of her, where she's, you know, new to the table. So a lot of players wouldn't have said anything to do that. She did in her speech afterwards, because obviously winning her biggest event ever.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Tactically, yeah, she's got an unbelievable. She's got power to match Gohar. And not many, there's nobody that can say that really. And then she's got this ability to finish balls, and she moves very well. But what I was impressed with was her defensive play and the way she used the front wall. Yeah. From where I've seen her play, where it is literally a plan A, and it's just like very fast, hard hitting, she adjusted a bit more in the final. And I thought, wow, that's happened just literally like that. Somebody's told her to do these things. She without bigging up the whole thing, she listened to the commentary, which can be useful for people sometimes. From the match with the Melissa Alves, and she changed things straight away. And you get players that will have to then go away and work on changing things for it to be implemented. But she was able to then implement that 2 days later, and that to me is really impressive and a massive warning sign for all the other players that are on the tour that are seeing her as a competitor, because she, in my book, has got the potential to go well into the top four.
Yeah, definitely. And it was amazing to see as well, just the dynamic between her and her coach. I think his name, Tiago Gorelli, I think his name is.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I think that's a new, from what I've understood, he went to Roehampton University and now he's the coach there. So she's going to finish her studies at Roehampton this summer.
Yeah.
Before that, literally up until very recently, she was being coached by Phil Rushworth, who's the coach at Wimbledon Rackets and Fitness and plays some age group squash and was a really good player back in the day. So he spent years with her, actually. So
Okay.
I want to make that quite clear because, you know, obviously Tiago's come on and been there and she's obviously comfortable with him, but Phil Rushworth has done all the hard yards with her, and I don't know if that relationship is going to continue or not. But obviously, it's what's happened has worked brilliantly, and she's maybe building a new relationship with the Tiago, who I don't know a huge amount about, but we'll find out.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, between the two of them anyways, he's come a long way, and it's great to see someone young and new that's going to challenge.
Oh, the women's. I mean, it's amazing for the women's tour. You know, you're
Yeah.
talking a new nation. You know, not Japan have always played. You know, they always played. Even back in Dad's day, he did a lot of tournaments in Japan. You know, there's been big Japanese Opens and stuff, but we haven't had anything properly substantial out there for a long period of time, and it's really exciting. And her persona on court is really cool because she's bowing. She's got that
Oh, yeah.
politeness and bowing, but then when it comes to the killer shots, I mean, she lets out an absolute ripper of a scream, and she's got real warrior, you know, that kind of samurai warrior side in her.
Absolutely, yeah. The
I
samurai
find it,
princess.
yeah, she's a honestly, she I mean, she the way she hits the ball, it's like she has got a sword. I mean, I know it could be perceived as cliche, Japanese player samurai, but I mean, you know, you wouldn't want her coming at you with a swing if she was angry. I mean, she proper samurai. It's quite funny because at the moment there's that classic show they made a long time ago, and they've remade it called Shogun, and it's on
Yeah.
Disney. Shogun, which I'm going to watch because I'm fascinated by the Japanese culture. I love it.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
I love
I
it.
like it as well. I watch quite a bit of the historical Korean dramas as well. It's a bit of Japanese influence in there, obviously. It's fascinating stuff. But Joe, I wanted to ask you as well. Obviously, another breath of fresh air, in my estimation, is the new Assal, the new look Mustafa Assal. Now, obviously, he's working with James Willstrup, and James has had an incredible up until now, anyways, influence on and impact on him. But in my estimation, I think the person who should be applauded with what we see right now is Mustafa himself for actually going out, taking this on and knowing that he had to do what he had to do. I mean, he's been playing the way he had been playing for forever. So
Yeah,
to go
I mean,
there and to make those changes.
I want to make it clear that Mustafa is a really, really good kid. Like he's a young man, should I say? I've been around him a lot. A lot of people again don't realize the behind the scenes scenario. So you've got these opinions and what we say on commentary or whatever. They've got no idea of the behind the scenes because they wouldn't have an idea of behind the scenes. So he's a really good kid. He's very playful. He's got an amazing sense of humor, and he's obviously been under a lot of pressure with everything within Egypt. It happens. There's a lot of expectation, as you can imagine, and comparisons to all those great players before him. And the fact that he's working, James, I've got the utmost respect for James. James was one of the great players, and he's a really top guy. He's a lovely guy, and I think they have quite an interesting little bond together, a calming bond. And I would like to see Mustafa get fitter. I have to be like blunt with it. I think he needs to be a lot fitter because the game that he plays when he needs to, you know, without all the funny business, is an outrageously explosive game where he just does stuff and you're like, I don't see that with any other player. No other player can do that. And to be able to do that in waves, because it would have to be waves, I want to see him a lot fitter. Now, I know James is doing a lot on his movement patterns and Also, body correction. James was the reason James Waltrip, at his height and the way he played and all the eras that he played through, which were a lot, was able to have such a successful and such an established career, take away the best ball control in the world. He was obsessed with maintaining the body, you know, with the glutes, with the adductors, with the core. He was always doing this all the time, like ridiculously. So he's so tuned into that, and he's been trying to get that into Mustafa, because Mustafa, although he's got this amazing athleticism, he's like this kind of powerful rubber band. He doesn't understand about glute activation and protection of the hips and these things that will give him longevity in his career, But for me, he needs to be doing that, but also some really brutal, hard physical sessions to get his confidence up that he can be on there and last physically with, you know, Paul Cole and these Ali Farag and Diego and all these players,
that,
you know.
I mean, One of the things that I've noticed anyways, he doesn't have that intensity. Now I was going to ask you why, but is that why? Is it because he's not fit enough? Is it because
I would say he's probably in a slightly confused area at the moment, because it was that kind of fight the fight, which when you're playing in Egypt, the crowd are going bonkers. You know, it enhances this, you know, this, you get this momentum, like having played in Egypt myself and being there commentating, you know, by the stands, being in the atmosphere, it just becomes this, like this unbelievable wave of this. And you just, the momentum that happens, then it's, you see these points happening so quickly, quick with the Egyptian players at the top level when they've got the crowd behind them. And that's happened a lot. You know, you look at where he's really been very successful. He's won the US Open, which was amazing, but he's won 3 World Tour finals. He's been very successful in his own backyard in Cairo. And I do feel that he needs that raging bull. He needs that in his game because of the outrageously explosive movement and the hitting and the destructive winners that he can create. And he's not quite getting back to that yet. And then the other side of the coin is he also needs the steady control to give himself a breather. Even if he does get very, very fit, he needs to steady the ship down the backhand wall and use the accuracy and use some good defensive play. So, you know, but I would like to see him fitter. I'd like to see him fitter personally. I did say that to him quite a while ago, that he needs to get a lot fitter. I mean, it's harder to improve your technique, I would say, and skill and tactics and understanding of the game. It's still hard to get fit, but it's easier to get fit than to work on to improve the other things.
Yeah, that's the hard. I mean, putting in the, you know, doing this, whatever you have to do to get really fit, like you said, that's the easy stuff, isn't it? As long as you have the wherewithal to put yourself through it.
Yeah, and he's got an amazing, you know, he has got this ridiculous, he's tall and powerful, but yet rubbery and flexible. Mm-hmm. And he's got a lot of the attributes there, and he could become physically a real monster. You know, he could be, if he gets the right training program with all the stuff that James is adding in terms of taking care of his body, he could be a monster, which is exciting. It's exciting.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it bodes well, with the remainder of the season lying ahead, but we do have London coming up, and
yes,
in terms of, you know, the men's draw, Ali's obviously not playing, but it's going to be interesting. You've got everyone else playing, Assal, and he's slated to play Cole in the semi. And
No. So Paul Cole's number one seed, Mustafa Assal's number two. Mustafa was meant, if it was on.
Oh, right.
So if it's on seeding and ranking, as it were, he was due to play Tarek Momen in the quarterfinals, but Momen's now pulled out as of yesterday.
Oh, really?
So that changes that. But what's going to be interesting is that this is a best of three format up until the semis.
Okay.
And when you think of his best of threes with the World Tour finals, and then it's the semis, best of five, final best of five. It's interesting. I've been going through some stats and it's really fascinating. And then the best of three opens up for the other players as well. You know, the lower ranked players, it opens up an opportunity. You've seen, I mean, Victor Kruijns managed to beat Paul Cole in the Tournament of Champions in a best of five. But he also beat him in a best of three in Canary Wharf some years back. And Paul Cole's had a great track record there. He's won it 3 times. the best of three leaves them a little bit vulnerable, these top guys, at, you know, in the early rounds, because the lower ranked players can have a real go at them.
Yeah, no, they can't.
You've got Baptiste Mosotti in his half, but then you've got Gouad. So Gouad, I mean, there's some big names in there. So the bottom half, Gouad's in there. Masotti's in there, who's a danger. Took out Mustafa at Grasshopper Cup, 11-8 in the third. It was a bit wayward, but Masotti got the result, which was a great result for him. You've got Gouad, who's a nightmare. We know that. Yeah. He beat Mohamed.
And he doesn't have to play Sherbaghi this time around.
Sherbaghi's in the top half, and Mohamed's got Yusuf Ibrahim, second round, best of three.
They've had every time they play, five.
Best of three, though. That's best of three. So, yeah, and you've got Marwan, and then that's if Mohamed gets through and Marwan get through, then they'll play each other in the quarters. And then if Paul gets through, he's got Ferez Dasuki. Alilainen's gone, he's moved now. He was going to be playing Joel Makin. So Joel, it could be a Joel Paul Cole quarter final in the top half if he gets past. It will be. I mean, it's going to be brilliant, and that's just the men's. And then in the women's, you've got.
Well, I was going to say about the women. The women's is going to be.
It's going to be brilliant because you've got the three big guns with Nour El Shabini top half, Gohar's bottom half with El Hamami, but then El Hamami in the second round's got Watanabe.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you've got Sherbini on the top. She's going to get through. It's going to be probably Gohar and Hamami in the semi. Is there any other?
El Hamami's got Watanabe at best of three. So, you know, watch this space. She's going to be nervous against her. You know, Hanya's superb. I mean, Hanya's amazing, but she's going to be edgy with Watanabe massively.
So is there anyone in the women's game? I mean, we talk about Ali and everything that he's done this year, but what about Sherbini? I mean,
she's outrageous. She's the best female player ever to play the game.
Yeah, that's the conversation.
In my opinion, in my dad's opinion, she's outrageous. And you're talking about someone that has played so many massive tournaments, injured to hell, in a lot of pain. Yeah. And she gets on with it. When she had the back spasm, she was in a tangle, and she's what she did. And you know,
remember
what? And
last season, she played in a cast or something, didn't she?
She had a cortisone injection in her knee literally just before she went on when she won the Worlds in Cairo. Mm. She's just another, she's so hard. And when she hits the deck, when you see her hit the deck, she doesn't, you know, daintily hit the deck. She slams on the bloody floor and really hits it hard, gets up again. Whereas a lot of the blokes are rolling around like absolute, you know, she's a joke. She's like the warrior princess. I don't care, you know, what people have about the nicknames. I love the players on the whole love the nicknames. They've used them to market themselves. It helps to get young kids interested when you see the nicknames. It brings attention to those personalities. I was told originally not to do it. I ignored the people that told me to, and I went on, and it's, you know, the warrior princess is one of the very best ones.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's so fitting as well. Yeah.
Yeah. The women's game is unreal, and it's getting better and better. And it's a real shame. Amanda Sobey, what happened to her is dreadful. She'll definitely be back. She'll be back. Definitely. I've got Naylor Gillis, what she's done is extraordinary. Sadly, Joelle King doesn't look like she's being able to play stuff. Sarah Jane Perry's now dropping off from there. But then you've got Olivia Weaver coming through, Tina Gillis coming through. Sabrina Sobey is always very dangerous.
Yeah.
Hopefully some of the English girls coming through as well. There's a lot of talent there.
Well, I've been impressed with Jasmine Hutton. I mean, she's got a great game.
She has. I mean, she led. She had all those years with Rob Owen. Rob did an amazing job with her. With all, you know, so many of those players, and obviously one's still with him continually now. And he's done a great job. And he has coached so many different players. He's still working with Katie Maleff, who's very talented. I'd like to see more consistency with her, hopefully, when she's had an injury and she's come back. But she's very talented. She's a really unique squash player. He's obviously done amazing. What he's done with Nelly Gillis is unbelievable. It's more impressive. It's more impressive what he's done with Nayla than it is with Paul. Because when he inherited Paul, Paul was four in the world. When he inherited Nayla, I mean, she was at least outside top 20.
Yeah.
And what he's done with Nayla is unreal. Like she'll go and do all the physical stuff that she's done with and all her diet because she's obsessed with that. And she's like literally on it like there's no tomorrow. But the tactical side and the technical side, credit where credit's due. To me, that's the most impressive. Player that he's kind of produced, the way he shaped someone like that to loads of people. If you'd have said, and this is no disrespect to Nayla at all, would she be top 10 in the world? No chance. A lot of people would have said that. And then she's there at four. She's vulnerable at four, you know, because these girls are on the hunt. She's now being hunted
so
at four outside the big three. She's vulnerable at four. But I mean, unbelievable. Maximum respect to her. So the way he's shaped and created her, you know, it's brilliant, superb.
Yeah, her game's really, really improved, and you know, she's added a lot of a lot more to her game over the last year, even.
Yeah, no, it's been really, really good, and I hope she stays loyal with him, and you know, and continues that relationship. I'm sure she will.
Now, Joey, I did not. I usually do listen to Squash Radio. I missed the episode where you were on with Bill and the fellas, and so obviously there's a bit. You guys probably talked a bit about the PJ JB, or is it JB and PJ squash?
It's JB. It's an original, Jerry. It's a very it took PJ. PJ's favorite thing is I'll have a think when I ask him something. And that's a real problem because when PJ starts thinking, you probably won't hear anything for 6 months. So, yeah, it's very original. JB, PJ, squash camps. I'm dyslexic, so, you know, I'd probably get it the wrong way around. But, yeah, we have been talking about it. Yeah, so we've been talking about it for a long period of time. Anyway, the opportunity arose where we have been able to take on the facilities at Millfield during the holidays, and you just don't get in England. There's nothing like it, and it's can compare with all the American universities and schools that and the facilities as you well know in America are amazing.
Yeah.
But it's all on site there with all the squash, the gyms, the athletics track, the pool, the accommodation, and the nutrition is amazing. So the food it's all there. So, and it's a beautiful campus, and it felt like the right thing to do. We've gone for 10 days. It's the 14th of July to the 24th. We've gone for 10 days because we're opening up to internationals so that people can travel and make the most of, you know, with jet lag. And as we know, jet lag and traveling, we do it all the time. So to really lay it out there, and my dad will make some appearances. We're going to have some more coaches coming in. We're capping it at 24 maximum. So we want it to be very, very specialist and very, you know, a lot of intense work with the individual players as well from that 24. And it's really, really exciting. Just think between the two of us, PJ was an ex-world number four.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did okay. I did all right as a player. Mm. And I've got the input from my dad. And I've also commentated on, along with PJ, a lot of matches of a lot of great players. And, you know, with all our jokes and all the rest of it, I've, you know, absorbed a lot of squash. So I've got a lot to offer from that point of view. And I always enjoyed
something
doing it.
Just to stop you there, I mean, I don't think you give yourself enough credit. When I listen to Squash TV, I mean, I learn a lot from just, you know, the commentary, the insight that you have, what the players are doing, how they build rallies, different things like that. And you obviously, you know the game as well as anybody does. And so this is a great opportunity. It's for elite, mostly high-end.
Yeah, high-end juniors between 13 and 19. We're going that stage. We depending on how it all goes, we probably look to open it up for adults at some point. Not this summer, but we've got the facility use in the holidays when the school is broken up. So that offers up quite a lot throughout the year, depending on our schedules as well. But yeah, we just feel that we want to, and the way we look at it, there's going to be a lot of intense work, and it's going to be hard work, but there's going to be a lot of fun. PJ and I have a lot of fun. You know, we have a great chemistry and a great
rapport. I do remember, Jonah, and was it you and PJ doing court sprints in your underwear or something? And
yeah.
Is there going to be any of that?
Well, I have to be honest with you. I was in my own underwear. PJ was in some lovely lady's underwear. I'm not sure who it was, but it looked really good on him.
in your backyard, right? That was
in the back garden, yes. Right. But yeah, we have a lot of fun together, and it's bringing that to, you know, whether they're from these the kids that may come from America, it's very intense in America. You know, it's full on there, and it's like, well, you're going to train hard, you're going to work hard, you'll be tired, but you're going to have a lot of fun, you know, and that is so important for the kids to just let loose. And I feel we're not going to step on anyone's toes because we're doing this in the UK. We're not trying to take out an area in the States. Everyone's very territorial in the States. You know, they've all got their camps going. You certainly find out who your friends are and who might be interested in trying to see it as a respectable opportunity to put kids and say, you know what, I've got a couple of kids. They'll have a great meet Jonah Barrington, train with you guys, fly over to England. It could be quite exciting for, you know, kids from America for that. That's obviously a market that a lot of people look to. We're certainly looking to, and bringing them out of their kind of comfort zone in America. But yeah, we're not stepping on anyone's toes, and we know a lot of the coaches, and we, the ones that do get sent from whoever might be pro myself and PJ or respectful of what we could do, you know, we'll converse with them to find out about the players and get a background on the players and just offer up and try and enhance what they're already doing. You know, it won't be, well, this is the way you should play because, you know, we think that it's this way and all that kind of mumbo jumbo. It's working well with what's there. And if they can come away and they've improved and they've got some things they can work on with their coaches, and that's amazing. But there's no kind of disrespecting in terms of, well, why are you playing like that? You shouldn't be, you know, we're not, that's not what we're about. So I wanted to make that clear, Jerry, because it, you know, the American market is a very competitive market and it's quite a paranoid market.
Right. PJ's been over there for a while, and I think he's in some way, shape, or form doing his own coaching over there. So he,
I think that's so. What he's doing. Apparently, although he's pretty much on the driving range or the golf course. But no, yeah, I mean, PJ's been out there for a long, long period of time, and he's great with youngsters. You know, he's got a calming influence. He's very understanding. They like him. You know, he's been there a long period of time, and he's never coached at a club. He's always done private clients, and he's one of the only coaches that's probably had a long career just private client after private client. And that says something about him, you know, where there's trust there, they're comfortable with him. The kids really like him. He keeps in touch with a lot of the kids that he's coached that go off, obviously, to a lot of them go off to university. Well, they all go off to university in America, but he still keeps in contact and hears from them. And they're in their, you know, late 20s, early 30s. I mean, the fact PJ is nearly 70, I think that's a good effort.
Yeah, absolutely. So if anyone's interested,
So if anyone's interested, it's jbandpjsquashcamps.com, and there's all the info on there and to register and the pricing and everything and any questions. There's frequently asked questions on there. We've covered all the territory. So yeah, they're welcome to inquire and we can kind of go from there, but it will be filling up relatively quickly, which is exciting. So there is only 24 spots, and it is boys and girls. So it's mixed. Yeah, it's mixed.
Brilliant. Now, before you go, Joey, I just wanted to ask you, I sent you a message on the Facebook during the, during Optasia. Jamie Maddox's wife were in the front row there at one of the matches and seated next to them. And I had no idea who it was. Obviously he's quite a famous squash coach, as it turned out. Mo Khalifa was there.
Mohammed Khalifa, yeah.
And I thought it was George Washington. I had no idea.
He's 82 now, Mo. I mean, I've been obviously doing my usual cheekiness and saying he's as old as Moses, but he He played in my dad's era. He was probably just outside top 10 in the world. A really great player, amazing guy, but then did amazing in the age group. So when he moved over from Egypt to England, he was based up in the northwest of England for quite a long period of time, up at New Brighton. And he used to win all the age group stuff by a distance. And I think he still goes on court now. But he always comes to the UK events. He also goes back to Egypt. He's got a place and his family is still out in Egypt. So he'll come and he'll be at El Gouna event and the Worlds in Cairo. But the players know him and respect him. And he's a lovely bloke. He's a great guy. And he's always there with the Egyptian players. And he knows everyone. Everyone knows him. And he's obviously got that amazing hair, Jerry. He could lend you some.
I wish I had some of those flowing locks that he had. Yeah.
Oh yeah, no.
He looks like a young Chris Walker.
Yeah, he's amazing. He's a really good guy, a real character. He actually appeared with he likes bringing chocolate to tournaments, so he appeared with loads of Cadburys and Twixes and things for poor old Ali Farag who couldn't eat them at that time, but. You know, I'm sure he devoured them at 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever it was.
There was one, it just came to mind. You brought Ali up just before you go there was one thing I wanted to ask you. Ali could have broken his fast. What time? Like around, you said like 6:30 ish.
No. He could have broken his fast. So he stopped eating around about 4 a.m. So right. He stopped eating the day he played around about 4 a.m., eating right. And drinking at 4 a.m.
And then
he broke his fast. It was about 6:13. So it came to the fifth game. It was only in the fifth game, after the fourth game, and he had half a bottle of water, which I found a bit strange. I thought he would have had a bottle of electrolytes and carbohydrates. You know, the problem is, Jerry, is obviously your stomach's shrunk like there's no tomorrow from not eating. And then you've only got 2.5 minutes to consume something that, because you don't want to go the other way and expect, you know, where you basically bloat yourself and end up having a stitch or an issue that way. So, but the fact he only had half a bottle of water, I did find that weird. I thought he was going to have at least some magic powder in there that would give him something. Yeah. So that was a bit strange. I did with my sports science brain, which, you know, I managed to get a degree somehow. I found that a bit odd.
I was going to ask though, just in terms of, you know, the scheduling, could they have not scheduled, I guess that's favoritism, but at the same, couldn't they have scheduled the matches?
You know what, Jerry, that is a really, you know, that point you just said there, and that wasn't talked about. And that's a really, really good point. Another point that was there is, and this is, it's like, how do you kind of monitor it would be with those players that are doing Ramadan.
Yeah,
in the towel box, could they go, you know, when it's a towel wiping or a court maintenance, could they not go and have a drink?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Could they not go and have a drink? I mean, but then you've obviously got players that will then abuse that possibly, or the other players that aren't doing Ramadan, we'd be like, well, that's not fair. It is their choice to do Ramadan. It is their choice. It's a very difficult scenario because obviously it's hugely, you know, this is such a massive part of the Muslim religion. And, you know, there's a lot of Muslim players that are playing the PSA World Tour. So, but what your point was, could he have played a bit later? Yeah, the scheduling could have been done a bit later. Yeah. I don't see a problem. And I'll tell you what, Paul Cole wouldn't have caused the problem. Paul Cole would have been as good as gold with it. There'd be other players, Jerry, that would have caused the problem, definitely. But Paul would have been, well, if we play later, that's fine. I don't mind. If he can eat, I don't care.
It seemed like it was a bit early in the day. I mean, it's still some of these matches go on in some events until...
You know what? It's a superb point. You know, you've come up with an absolutely great point. I'll certainly be taking that to the PSA.
Well, I don't want to stir up any trouble.
Oh, no, you have, Jerry. Jerry, you have it. It's going to go on Squash Stories and you'll have loads of, you'll get trolled now.
Well, I always do. So. Anyway, Joey, really appreciate your time, buddy. And great to see you. Thanks for coming on. And let's hook up in about episode 500.
Oh, I tell you what, it's brilliant what you're doing, Jerry. You've got, you know, such a vast array of people that you've chatted to and Sorry it's taken so much time, but thank you for the persistence and thank you for your time as well. But that's great. Keep in touch, obviously.